One of the things that I like to do when I go to make a call on somebody in the hospital or in a nursing home is to try to get them to tell their story. And I, especially if I don't know them, I'll ask them something to say like this: how did you meet your husband? Or how did you meet your wife? And then, they're always kind of startled with that question, and they kind of smile, and then they begin to talk about when they had their first date and how they started to have their courtship and then finally make their decision about getting married. And frankly, I love to listen to stories and to anyone's story. But it's not always easy to get somebody to tell their story because things can get in the way. And I learned this on my very first call as a pastor to someone in the hospital. I had been a new, brand new, you could still see the green behind my ears, pastor 1 week. And I got this call to come and see this elderly person who wanted to see a Lutheran pastor. So the problem was I didn't quite catch the name. And it was this kind of generic name, genderless, like Winifred Williman or something like that. And so I thought, oh, well, you know, when I get there, I'll be able to tell whether it's a man or a woman. Well, that didn't happen. I got there, and there was this person sitting in a chair, and you know that they had short, white, gray hair, kind of that bed hair, you know, sticking out straight, you know, all over the place. So I couldn't tell, which made me a little bit nervous. But, you know, I was going to go in, and I was going to pastor that person. So I go in, and I have to tell you, I was good. Okay, I was friendly, I was outgoing, I really, you know, it was like all those years I had been in seminary to learn how to be a pastor, it all came rushing out at once, and I mean, I just was friendly and full of energy, and that person just sat there like a lump, no response, nothing. I wasn't one to be deterred. So I started to talk to them about my family and about the church I served and all kinds of things. And again, no response. I started to get desperate, inside dying. And then suddenly this nurse opens the door and says, "Winnie, are you done yet?" To which I kind of, well, number one, I found out she was a woman, but I looked more closely, and indeed, Winnie was sitting there, but she wasn't sitting on a chair. She was sitting on a toilet, which explained the odor in the room. And I looked at her, and I said, "Winnie, I bet you want me to leave right now, don't you?" And immediately there's this response. So I turned around, slinked out into the hallway, terribly embarrassed, thinking they never told me this in seminary, wondering how I could go back into that room. Well, I did. And we had a delightful conversation after she was done. It was a lot of fun. But you see, I learned that day that there's things that get in the way of someone telling a story. And now when I go see somebody in the hospital, where they are sitting, that's the first thing I observe. Okay? I'm not going to do that again. Well, today we're here to talk about stories. That's right. How fun it is to tell stories, even the embarrassing stories. For you see, we're going to start once again what we might call the story lectionary, or we call it more the narrative lectionary. That collection of Bible readings that tells God's story. Through the stories of a lot of people, like Abraham, Jacob, Moses, the Israelites, David, Solomon, the prophets, all the way to the story of Jesus and then the disciples in the church. Always asking, what are the stories telling us about the larger story of God? And more importantly, how does God's story connect to my own personal story? We did this for the first time as a church last year, as we asked over and over again, how do we fit into God's story, this great story of Him redeeming, starting with Moses and the children from Israel, you know, in captivity, rescued them, redeemed them, saved them. We kept on seeing and telling that story over and over again. We looked at it then in the story of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke. Well, this year we're going to do the same thing again. We're going to start at the very beginning of creation today. And we're going to use 15 other Old Testament stories that will lead us to the story of Jesus once again, but not in the Gospel of Luke. This time we're going to go through the Gospel of John. And the question we're going to be asking is, are we in step with Him? And the story that He continues to write in the world today. So, let's get started. We normally ask you to open your Bibles to follow along. And this day, this is the easiest passage to find. All you have to do is go is page 1. It's not going to get any easier than this, folks. And as we open to page 1 of our church Bibles, we find this magnificent poem about creation, carefully constructed with 7 stanzas that are 7 days. And after each stanza, there's this common, beautiful refrain that goes something like this, and there was evening, and there was morning the first day. Then the second time the refrain comes, the second day, and so on. And now let's get one thing straight. This first chapter of Genesis was not meant to ever describe how God created this universe. It does not contain any scientific formulas or instructions as to how He did it. No. This first chapter of Genesis was written to celebrate this abundant, creative God and to introduce the first chapter. It's almost like a prologue to a greater story. And now, many times we've heard this, and the reason why I introduce it with that, what gets in the way, sometimes what gets in the way of a Bible story is we've heard it too many times. And we miss it, seeing it fresh and new. So today I want to suggest there's 3 words or 3 observations about the story of creation that we can take home today. And I want you to say them with me, okay? God's creation is emergent, abundant, good, not perfect, okay? Emergent, abundant, good, but certainly not perfect. So, let's begin. The story, why do we say the story of God's creation is emergent? Well, because it is basically a story of this unfolding, gradual kind of creation. It doesn't just boom, plop down, complete. In other words, there is a beginning. There's a time when the universe did not exist. Verse 2, the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep. It had a beginning. Before the universe, there was only chaos, darkness, deepness, no sense of time, no substance, a deep nothingness, except God, who is pictured hovering or sweeping over this vast ocean of nothing. Then God speaks, and different parts of creation begin to emerge. Light, water, sky, land, vegetation, plants, trees, fish, birds, animals, and finally, humanity. Notice each day is said to be good, but it seems like there's an unwritten message that it's not complete each day, but there's something more to come. There's a first, there's a second, there's a third. And slowly but surely, God's creation unfolds and emerges all by God's insistent creative power. It's like he's down at the water coaxing it all forth. And even when humanity is created, it begins with just two. Creation doesn't come fully populated, but it's meant to begin and slowly unfold and be this constant, vibrant, exciting, and perhaps even difficult moments. So what does it mean for us to say that God's creation is emergent, to believe in an emergent creation? Well, first of all, I think it becomes a challenge for us to care for it. To care for it. Think for a moment. If creation is a fragile gift given to us to care, dress, and till it, to steward it wisely so that his creation continues to emerge, we have to do everything we can to make sure that it continues to emerge. Like a seed sprouting from this tiny little seed. But on a deeper level, I think it also means that we need to be open to new, the different next steps of God's creative and redeeming story. To be open to whatever he is doing in our lives and in our world. To live as we know and we believe God isn't done yet. He hasn't written, we still have more of a story to live. There's more work to do in this world. Secondly, we say God's creation is what? Abundant. Okay, abundant. I wasn't sure it was there. Thanks, Steve. Abundant. Okay, we got to say it. You know, God's creation is abundant. Okay, there we go. One of the things I noticed for the first time, I've read this passage hundreds of times. And this time I started to count up words having to do with just vibrant life. I counted up the word everything or every. And this is just the sixth day. What comes, when you see that, what kind of comes to mind there? He uses every a lot, right? There's a lot, everything. Throughout the whole passage, he uses the word 23 times. That's a lot. And when he talks about, you know, there's life, there's vibrancy, there's multiplying, there's you know, just all kinds of this abundance of God. Variety. You know, he doesn't say there's just one tree or one plant. He says tree of every kind. You can't imagine how many there are and the variety and the diversity. When he says the fish are created, it says the fish are like a swarm. There's all these tons of fish swarming and swimming all over the place. It's pictured like God is this great sower with this bag of life seeds, and he's just throwing it out all over the place, not caring where it all lands. Abundance, plenty, and profusion. And you see, that has implications to us also. Do we believe in a God of abundance or scarcity? Do we celebrate all that he continues to give, living with gratitude and thanksgiving, or do we sense, live with, well, he hasn't given me enough. I want more. what does this mean to a nation living with incredible abundance in the midst of nations that have so little? What does it to believe in the abundance of God if we hold on and are self-focused and self-centered? And then, do we as people of God celebrate the diversity, the abundance, and the variety of life and people in this world? Or do we look at people who are different than us and say, they need to become like me? Do we celebrate God's diversity? And we look at people and say, oh, they may be a little bit different than me, but they're God's children. Lastly, we say that God's creation is what? Good, not perfect. Okay. Good, not perfect. Over and over again, we hear of God looking over his creation. You know, what he accomplishes. And he says, and it's this beautiful refrain, and God saw that it was what? Good. But not perfect. And what do we mean by that? Well, first of all, it's an interesting Hebrew word, good. The word is actually tov, okay, tov. And what it means is agreeable, excellent, pleasant, okay? It's good. So what's the big deal we're trying to make between good, not perfect? Well, what do you think about when you hear the word perfect? Well, it's more of a philosophical, platonic idea of an abstract state or condition. When you think of something perfect, it's fully complete. There's no change. There's no need for change. It's fully formed. It's an ideal. Kind of static. And you see, sometimes we drag that abstract Greek idea of creation being perfect into the story. But you see, that's never what in Hebrew, Jewish concept of creation. You know, I have a relative who will say to me, oh, I had a perfect marriage. My husband was perfect. It was perfect. Well, let me tell you, looking on the outside of that, it wasn't perfect. He was far from perfect, okay? And, you know, I got to thinking about that whole idea of a perfect marriage. I don't want a perfect marriage. I don't want a marriage that's constantly the same, that there's nothing more to come and it's just all fully developed. No, I want a marriage that's more real. It's good. I want one that's alive and ever-changing with lots of possibilities. I want one that's full of surprises, not complete, hard times, pleasant times, sorrowful times, forgiving times, apology times. I want one that's alive. And that's the sense of creation. It's good, but it's not perfect. What I mean is it's not just static. There's power. There's dynamo. There's change that's constantly coming. It's alive with possibilities. And later we learn that this goodness in creation is not lost or destroyed because of what Adam and Eve, when they bite that fruit from the forbidden tree. That's more of a Greek concept, not Jewish. Not Hebrew. No, what we find is goodness is redefined. It's deepened as God's emerging story changes and shifts and deepens. Yes, he disciplines his children. He casts them out of the garden. But you know where he said, when you take that apple and you eat it, you die? He didn't do that. Instead, we see God's goodness come as a parent who takes his children and he clothes them to hide their shame, to help them with their guilt and their failure. And his goodness then becomes a story that emerges that now he's going to deepen their relationship with him. He's not only creator, but he's a God, a parent of abundant love and forgiveness. And now he's going to start to school them, teach them about what it means to be in a relationship with him as the creation emerges. And the question for us today is, can we trust in God, our loving and good parent, whose story is one of forgiveness, story is one of compassion, and a willingness to enter into each and every one of our circumstances to bring about his emerging, abundant, and good life? I don't know your particular story that you are living. I don't know your narrative. You may be feeling like, oh man, it's all screwed up. It's all fragmented. Oh, if you knew my life, my narrative, it's chaotic. Or it's just boring. I invite you this morning. I invite you to connect with God's story once again. Introduced in the creation, a prologue. And will climax in the life of Jesus, who promised that he came to bring life and to bring it abundantly, so that we can get in step with him. Amen. Please stand.